Welcome to episode 2 of A Capital Duo Talk Tech, brought to you by the interwebs. The interwebs, greatest thing since the wireless. Now, your hosts, Andy White and Pascal Klein. Thank you, 1950s Radio Man. Welcome to episode 2 of A Capital Duo Talk Tech. You will hopefully be noticing that our sound quality has greatly improved. We did get a bit of feedback on that one, and we're very sorry about the first episode being a little bit crappy. Hopefully things are sounding a lot better now. We're sort of figuring some of this audio stuff out as we go. We don't have a lot of really good equipment, so please bear with us. I'm Andy White, also known as ArcWhite. My email address, arcwhite@arcwhite.org. And I'm here with Pascal Klein, also known as Kleepass.
You can find me at Twitter, so Kleepass, same nickname, K-L-E-P-A-S, your ArcWhite, A-R-C-H-W.
A-R-C-W-H-I-T-E. Indeed. That's how we spell white.
My bad. Please feel free to email me as well. You can email either of us about anything to do with the show. So that's K-L-E-P-A-S at K-L-E-P-A-S.org, kleepass.org.
We now have a feed of this podcast up on arcwhite.org/feed/podcast. We're also available on the iTunes Music Store. So
just search for us there,
You can find us there. I should mention, hopefully this will be, we'll be putting this podcast out the same night we're recording it, fingers crossed.
Which is Monday, Australian Eastern Standard Time evening.
Yep. Because there's a Google Wave hackathon at the ANU on basically all of Saturday, starting at 9:30 in the morning.
That's this coming Saturday?
Yep.
At the Australian National University.
That's right. If you do a search for Google Wave hackathon and ANU, you should find the result, and I'll put a link up there after the show. If you're interested in going to that, you need to get your application in pretty much tonight, and you will get a Google Wave Developer Sandbox account, and it's some pretty cool technology to be playing with. I believe the lovely Pamela Fox, Google Developer Liaison, will be in attendance.
Yeah, from up in Sydney, she'll be coming down, I hear.
She's always fun to talk to, so if anyone's interested, get your application in as soon as possible. Now, into the show. This was originally going to be errata, but it's become so voluminous that I'm going to make Pascal do a completely separate subject out of it, and we're going to talk again about web typography and web fonts, because it seems to be a pretty popular topic.
So, as I mentioned in the last show, that things have been changing pretty rapidly, and again, that seems to have been the case, or rather, the other way you could put it is I found out additional information I didn't have that night. So the big thing really is that, so I'll actually get some errata out of the way, some actual errors I mentioned last time. So first off, the security flaw that I mentioned in EOT, and EOT is the embeddable OpenType sort of wrapper that you can wrap OpenType and TrueType fonts in, developed by Microsoft, was a Microsoft Windows IE problem and not inherent in EOT itself, as far as I understand it. So the other thing I mentioned was that EOT was kind of dead in the water, but since, and this is actually the primary source for most of the new information, TypeCon, which is a big type-related conference, was held.
We'll bet that one's a lot of fun.
It is indeed. I wish I could have been there. So yeah, that ran, and there was a, as the year before I hear, there was a web fonts panel discussion with a whole bunch of different panelists, so ranging from guys from the foundries, so guys who are individual type designers, to web developers, web designers, and whatnot else. And that was moderated, and it was done really quite well. And at the end, there were open questions made to the panel. Actually, that's how most of the panel, kind of the session ran. And it's a two-hour-long recording, so I think it's not something that you'd be particularly interested in listening to. But
not high on my list.
Not high on your list. But it is quite good, and I'm going to link it in the show notes. So I'm just going to quickly summarize some of the points that at least pertain to what we mentioned last time. So first off, EOT being dead in the water. Let's examine EOT a tiny bit more. So EOT really is like the best way to think about it is like it's a thick wrapper. So if you reconsider how what we mentioned last time, the .web fonts proposal, which is just sort of like a zip file of the font and the XML data, so EOT is kind of like a lot thicker than that. It's got more stuff in the wrapper that wraps that stuff together. So EOT was really rejected actually because it had a proprietary compression format, and because a lot of folks, including W3C folks, weren't happy with the URL binding. And the URL binding was the idea that you would In each EOT file, you would say this font file is only limited to this domain. So
right.
you couldn't just grab the EOT file and use it on your own website.
Do you know what their problem with that was?
They considered the idea too restrictive in general.
Okay.
Mandating that for every single thing. That was mandated. You have to have font.
It
wasn't optional, Ooh. From what I understand. So that was the main problem. So then came along EOT Lite, L-I-T-E, by Ascender. Which differs from EOT by just removing that trusted roots domain, so the URL
binding. Yep.
And it has removed the proprietary compression algorithm. Now, as far as I understand it, they've removed all compression, which is not the smartest of ideas moves either.
I don't know whether compression in a font is now, really
that's
such
the
a
thing.
Big deal.
It is a big deal.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it can be really quite a big deal. So some fonts can be up to like 2 megs in size, and you can smush them down quite a lot, yeah. So EOT Lite, you can think of it more of like a thin wrapper or a thinner wrapper. Now, the proprietary compression algorithm is called Microtype Compression, or I think MTX, and the patent for it is owned by Monotype. Now, MTX is not as efficient, so like a bunch of guys on the list did a comparison. They found that GZIP, that it's a bit better than GZIP, but LZMA shows like much, much better results. And I think it was like a 36%, like 36%
okay.
compression, yeah.
And when you're talking about potentially 2 megabyte files that are going to be,
yeah.
you know, you're going to have one or two or three per website for every website on the planet, you're talking about quite a bit of bandwidth potentially.
Yeah, yeah. So it's important to realize, though, that it's probably not in your interest to link up a 2 megabyte file because you only need like a very small subset of the characters
of course,
within
of
that.
Course.
So that's where subsetting comes in. So EOT Lite is not yet officially supported, but the interesting thing here is that sort of a quasi EOT Lite file, so basically an EOT file that has no compression and no URL binding, works in the existing implementation of IE.
Right, so they've used the existing EOT standard and yep. just cut out a whole bunch of the cruft.
And it still works magically.
And it still works. Okay, so they've hacked around the problem.
They've hacked around the problem. So really, if other browsers were to support EOT Lite without compression, you'd have web fonts tomorrow-ish, right?
Groovy.
So there's further that problem of it kind of sucks that you've got to use the WEF converter, which is like a Windows-only converter, to convert the font files into EOT, but that was only available for Windows, and it even had problems running under virtualization.
Oh, God.
So you needed Windows, really, which sucks. So there's now a project called TTF2 EOT, so TTF, the number 2, EOT, that converts, it's such like a small command line utility that converts TTF files to EOT. It's licensed under GPLv2. We're going to link that in the show notes. And further was the... there was also a concern raised at TypeCon that maybe the reason why EOT wasn't really being, you know, taken up was that maybe there was some negative stigma attached to the fact that it came out of Microsoft.
What? A bunch of designers not liking something that comes out of Microsoft?
Yeah.
Surely that's not the case.
So yeah, there was that. And it's a double-edged sword with everything. I mean, Microsoft is huge. There are some compartments that do, some laboratories that do kind of cool stuff and have nothing to do with the legal department, and then there are other groups that... It's like, you know, the Open Source Labs group are advocating free software stuff and giving money to the Apache Foundation, and then the legal department is trying to sue a free software project. So
yep.
it's such a huge company.
It's a huge, massive, monolithic... Well, not monolithic company, but
yeah.
a massive company, and there's a lot of different agendas and people doing different things.
Yeah, yeah. So finally, really, the Monotype noted that they want to sort of remove all the barriers to get EOT up there, because many people seem to think that EOT is the biggest chance, yeah, at least beside the .web font proposal. So they said they'll open source MTX if browser vendors agree to use. So nothing happened for a while, like that topic was dropped, and then one chap mentioned who came, I think he might have been an open source developer of some kind, he mentioned that, that really this is not the best way to go because MTX is like a black box and no one knows how good it is until you get to see the code and verify its quality. And it's now been shown that LZMA compression is much better and has no...
They could turn around and open source the MTX compression algorithm
yeah.
and we could find that
that's
it's
shite.
A great big dirty bunch of code that's
yeah.
full of
and that
exploitable holes.
And that the patent is entirely laughable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that may not be the case. I just want to point that out.
It all be the case, but it has been shown that LZMA is better, which is not patent encumbered.
Yeah.
So that's at least one point to take into consideration. So there's then there was another compression wrapper method put forth called ZOT, quite similar to sort of it's kind of halfway between web fonts and EOT, really. It's been discovered also that Typotech, who do the raw offering of TTFs and conversion to EOTs on the fly for IE, that they corrupt the name tables with referrer checking. Do you know anything about HTML name tables? Nothing I've ever really dealt with too much, so I was just wondering whether you had any details or any more information on that.
I couldn't tell you. I don't even know what that's referring to. I'm guessing it's something to do with the document object model.
Yeah.
In which case it's probably referring to... There are tables kept of the names. I'm not sure if that includes the IDs, but certainly the names of HTML entities within a document,
mm-hmm.
Which is especially useful for stuff like forms, because you need to know the names of stuff in forms.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of JavaScript uses that sort of stuff. And it's very heavily utilized on the back end of most browsers. So if what I'm thinking of is what that's actually talking about, and it's mm-hmm. entirely possible it isn't, I could be talking out of my ass here,
mm-hmm.
Then corrupting that would be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. That's what I always thought. Yeah, it got mentioned at the mailing list again, but there wasn't much extra information to go along with it. Seemed to be sort of like a given thing that people should understand. Well, I didn't, but yeah. You asked last session what occurs when the font isn't available. Now, yep. I mentioned that basically what would happen is the logical thing would be that the next font in the font stack would be mentioned, would be called upon.
But what if that's a web font as well?
Well, it would go down the list until you had one that was not a web font.
So would it keep trying to load all of them in succession?
It would, one after the other.
Oh dear.
Yeah, so ideally you kind of want one web font and not four or five in a row. That's kind of...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But it found out that Safari shows nothing until the font is downloaded and rendered.
Woo!
Which is kind of fail. So, like Firefox, you'll actually see everything renders.
The content. Whereas in Safari, you'll see a great big blank page of graphics and no text.
Yep.
Groovy.
Yeah, so, like, I've noticed this recently whereby, even locally, and I've got this font locally on my server, it's on a local testing environment, I'll reload the page, and there'll be that 2 second blip where Safari reloads those fonts. Even on the local server.
Is that after you've cleared cache?
After I've cleared cache. Yeah, so not the, I'm expecting that that'll be fixed in the future.
One would hope so.
One would hope so, yes. So that's just something to be aware of. Firefox just shows the next in line font until that's rendered, which is usually like a second or two, at least on a high speed connection. But it's another point to consider. So Firefox actually currently implements same domain name access restrictions. So I can't, well, no one can currently grab a TTF or OTF file, like link it from another server onto your machine. You've got to have that font file host on your own domain.
Oh, God.
You can, however, override the HTTP access controls on your server. It's just editing some stuff. And there's a link to a Mozilla how-to page that we'll put in.
That's all right. There is a workaround.
There is a workaround, yeah. But by default, which is not something I really take an issue with that much. You can't trust the font files. I guess
if that's what you're pushing for, I still think it's a bit drain-bramaged.
On the other hand, we can link images from other domains, whether they're copyrighted, whether they're licensed or not.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a...
Why are we pushing for all this access control all of a sudden?
Yeah.
It's not the way the interwebs were built.
There have been similar copyright issues for other media types in the last 10 years. Everything from ranging to MP3s to images.
Copyright issues in the last 10 years? I haven't heard anything about this. Why was I not informed?
So next up, I've actually seen a few problems in hinting at small sizes. So people have started using the web fonts a lot more, particularly direct linking in Safari and Firefox.
Where are you going with this? Hinting at small sizes?
Hinting is the...
Doesn't sound wholesome at all.
No. Hinting... I should explain this, sorry. Hinting is essentially when fonts get rasterized on a pixel screen. The vectors, which is how the fonts are expressed, basically, they will have to be aligned to a pixel grid, which they're no longer... vector graphics.
Yep.
Then. Yep. So what can happen at smaller sizes is that, you know, the feet of a T or the crossbar of an F or a T or something like that, they can blur to the point where you can no longer read them properly.
So it doesn't look like a T.
No, it doesn't look like a T. Or it starts to look mangled. And if you have letters in succession to each other and they're all really small, it kind of gets crap. So the idea here is that a lot of the fonts that exist currently for the web, like Verdana and Georgia, they've all been hinted at small sizes. So they're still, what'll happen is they'll make a compromise and say, we never blur this pixel, ever. Because it's vital to show that.
So if it's rasterized at this sort of size, always leave this part of it visible.
Now, when you're working in the print arena, you don't need to do much hinting because it'll never be rasterized. It'll be sent straight to the printer and then printed out, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Happy analog world.
Which has got, you've got a much higher resolution, so you don't have to worry about that. However, in the digital world, we've got rasterization, and when that happens at small sizes, you need hinting tables. And you can do auto-hinting, which is making the computer run through it and try to figure out which pixel should never be smooshed or blurred. But you kind of want a human eye to go over it. And a lot of these fonts just have not had that happen to them. So, as usual, don't set text too small because it sucks for everyone. Most people.
I would have thought that that was pretty good advice at the best of times, even without hinting problems, but yeah.
Yep. So, next up, the listings of TTF and OTF files that are embeddable. We'll put up a link to fontsquirrel.com, as in fontsquirrel with a double R, EL.com. And there's a another link that we'll put up, which basically just lists fonts that are freely available for you to download, potentially even edit, upload to your own web server, and directly link to, because they've been licensed in various open source and Creative Commons and other similar licenses. So that's good. So there's at least like 15 up around already.
Delicious.
So by way of conclusion, things are moving. It's been considered the longer that Safari and Firefox and other browsers like Opera and Chrome now who are going to be native linking to TTF and OTF files, the more primacy that will get and the more usage that will get, which will suck for things like EOT. So basically, the longer these technologies are out there, the more use they'll get and the less likely people will want to move from them.
Yep, they'll become a de facto standard basically, just by virtue of and not having anything better around.
Yep, and once things are a de facto standard, they tend to get accepted by the W3C. Generally, that happens like there's like a 5 to 10 year gap, though, between that happening. Yeah. Next up, Typekit will, of course, gain traction. And as we stated last time, and I want to really hammer this point home, I haven't read this on any other blog, and this is entirely my opinion, but again, just like we mentioned just then, as things become de facto standards, it'll be harder for people to move away and people to adopt other technologies, right? And if people, particularly if people are paying customers of a service that works well.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I mean, we're not talking about the kind of technology that has to be wholesale replaced. We're talking about the sort of thing where you can actually use one of these technologies. So you could use Typekit. You could implement Typekit on your site.
Yep.
While still linking to a TTF or OTF file in the native browser
true.
Way.
That is true, yes.
So, at the end of the day, implementing Typekit...
But the licensing will be different, which case you will not... There was no chance in hell that you'd be able to use the same font.
That's true. You might have to change fonts in that case.
Yeah. So that's at least a point worth considering, but not necessarily a complete...
Certainly,
truth.
if you're working at Typekit right now, you probably want to hurry this particular process of changing the font adoption along.
Yeah, and at TypeCon, there were a few people like Monotype, like the representative from Monotype was like, "Oh yeah, we'd like to get the fonts with onto Typekit," and the Typekit guy was like, "Talk to me afterwards." this problem is now 11 years old. CSS 2. 1998 is when it came out, and that's when @fontface existed already. So, 11-year-old problem, and designers aren't happy about it. They want it now. Next up, we want to move away from web fonts. I think we've covered it quite well enough, and I have no real intention to continue it as a major section again, unless something really groundbreaking comes up.
Everyone's very relieved to hear that.
Yeah. So let's move into the next feature, and we had a bit of a think, and the thing that we wanted to cover was security. So web security for developers, designers, and anyone else who works on the web.
Yes. So, we're going to talk about security. We're going to talk about actual security. And then Pascal's going to take us on a bit of a meander around the...
perceived security.
...wanky subject of perceived security and design. It's wanky because he's a designer, and anything that a designer does is wanky.
Wanker.
It is.
Wankerism?
Wank? Wank? I think it's just wank. I think wank is the noun.
In terms of you referring to a single, it could be a wankerism.
No. That would be one specific instance of wank.
That's what I should have meant.
Yes.
We have to thank Ashley Kidd for that, who commented on the first podcast, actually.
What, with wankerism?
No. Oh,
he was referring to your stuff, right?
Yeah, no. We're rambling into a rat hole, but nonetheless. So, yeah, security.
Security. So we're going to try to avoid getting too overtly technical, but this next section will get a little bit technical.
At least the developer part of it.
If you're not a technically minded person, you can skip forward in the audio or just
go to the design bit where I start talking about more interesting and
wank.
Interesting stuff. And yes.
Yeah, the wank.
Wank.
The wank. I probably should say that I don't think all design is wank. I'm not one of those people. I'm really just doing this to pay Pass out. So, security.
And as we've heard, James likes it.
Mr. James. Palmy James loves it. He loves it when I give it to you.
You're a good stand-in.
Moving right along. Firstly, if you're, we're going to assume here that you're some sort of web developer and you're creating some sort of web application or working with a web application that, you know, is of an existing code base.
Mm-hmm. At least in your section.
Obviously. At least in my section. The wanky section later on will make similar but not quite the same assumptions. The first thing you need to do as a developer when you're deploying a web app, especially if you're deploying it out in the real world, is server hardening. Now, that's usually the job of system administrators, and if you've got system administrators, hopefully they know how to do that.
Give them a hug.
And if they don't, give them a slap on the backside, because that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Things like, for example, making sure you're running the correct web server. And by correct, I mean one that isn't full of security vulnerabilities.
Cough.
I'm not naming names.
Yeah, let's not.
A good web server can often be run in a troop jail or something similar. A troop jail is a FreeBSD concept it goes back quite a way. But the idea is that with a little bit of kernel magic, you lock your web server away in a portion of the file system, and you give it either copies of the executables that it needs to run,
mm-hmm.
or direct, you know, system links. Actually, they're usually a special modified type of system link,
mm-hmm.
to the actual location of the binaries on the file system.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, no. You don't link to the binaries. You can link to some of the data files, but linking to the binaries is bad. They have to have separate copies of the binaries.
So
now the idea here is that if your web server is compromised,
mm-hmm.
the kernel treats the web server as if it's running off. It's not quite running in its own, you know, virtualized environment, but its access to the file system is extremely limited.
Mm-hmm.
So that if it is compromised and, you know, they manage to run arbitrary code through what was your web server process, it can only access the files that you've specifically allowed it to access, and it can't access any other executables on the system that any of your other software is going to be using.
Yep.
So even simple stuff like you shouldn't give a web server access to a C compiler, for example.
Oh, goodness, no.
And in a typical setup, if your web server is compromised and you have a C compiler running on your computer, then they can run the C compiler remotely.
Mm-hmm.
That's bad times.
That's bad, yeah. So for those of us who don't have propeller hats permanently glued to our heads...
Oi!
So the best way to think of this is you're taking the things that are used by the web server and sticking them in their own sort of protected environment where they can't easily get out.
Bingo. That's it in a nutshell. It's not quite the same as virtualization, but same sort of concept.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, big thumbs up to running your web server either in a Troop jail or as a, you know, separate virtualized environment if you can do that. Mm-hmm. There's downsides to that as well, especially performance-wise, but the security gains are worth paying that price for.
Mm-hmm.
The next big subject is SQL injection attacks and databases. This one I see all the time. It's really, really common. There are a lot of web applications out there that don't check input received from the user to make sure that it doesn't contain malicious code.
Or executable things to begin with. Some, depending on what sort of data is being passed.
That's right. Especially with databases, the input that comes from a user, if it's not cleared or handled in a specific and sensitive way.
So the input here could be like a comment form.
The username field. Yep. Anything that the user can submit to your web application.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going and taking that data and passing it through to a database, there are ways to structure a piece of data that a user puts in. If I'm a malicious attacker, for example, I can put an apostrophe at the end of the input, and then a semicolon followed by a series of SQL commands.
Is it a real apostrophe or is it a dumb apostrophe?
It's a dumb apostrophe. You're okay. A dumb apostrophe. The sort of apostrophe that a user would put into a form.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
So a wrong apostrophe.
Not a HTML entity apostrophe, okay. or anything wonderful and magical like that.
Or a Unicode apostrophe.
I will hurt you.
Continuing.
Back to the subject at hand. So SQL commands are structured query language is the language that we use to manipulate databases typically these days.
Mm-hmm.
And if your input can be escaped and then arbitrarily executed on the database, a malicious attacker can delete anything in your database.
Edit, gain access to.
That's much worse. They can gain access to all of your information. They can access your user table. They can access
email addresses, passwords, anything.
God help you, you might have credit cards stored in your database.
And if they're not hashed, well, we'll get onto that in a second, but yeah, bad.
So, very bad times. And they really are a very common attack. I've tried a number of web applications that I've found out there just for shits and giggles, and discovered a number of SQL vulnerabilities.
You want to make yourself clear here, you didn't have any malicious intent. And
No. And I'm not naming names. It was just out of a curiosity more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And no damage was ever done. There's an easy way to test if you have an SQL injection vulnerability, and that is to enter an arbitrary piece of input, followed by an apostrophe and a semicolon, and then not necessarily all in capitals, but the convention is all in capitals, space tables,
mm-hmm.
and then another semicolon.
Mm-hmm.
And if that returns output that looks anything like a list of the tables in your database,
mm-hmm.
you've got an SQL injection vulnerability.
Ooh, bad.
Bad times.
Mm-hmm.
Similar and related to the SQL injection vulnerability are cross-site scripting attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these don't actually attack your web server. They allow a user of your web application to inject arbitrary, say, JavaScript, which can then attack other users of your web application.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you've got a comment field on a blog post, and you allow people to put HTML entities into their comments,
mm-hmm.
so they can directly enter HTML tags into a comment. One of those HTML tags happens to be script.
Yep, the script element.
Which means that they could, in theory, put arbitrary JavaScript into your page.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody else who comes along and looks at the comments attached to that post mm-hmm. will see, their browser will see the JavaScript, they'll load it and execute it as if it had come from your server.
Yeah, and that's the dangerous thing. It comes from your server and it's hard to detect because it's only in that comment, only on that page.
Bingo. It looks like legitimate JavaScript.
Because it comes from your website. Yep, exactly.
And if the user has an authenticated session running with your web application and they happen to have some sensitive information in there and you happen to have an AJAX API that's easily exploitable, the attacker that can then gain access to pretty much any information in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a class of vulnerabilities in people's browsers that they can exploit to spread malicious code.
As an example, is this a viable case where this could happen? You go to a website, you want to buy a book, and for books people can write reviews, and you have comment fields where people can put in the comment for the review, and they can put in some script stuff in there, and that JavaScript then impacts your purchase that you make.
That's right. Yes, absolutely.
So they could get your credit card details when you go to make the checkout purchase for that book, for example.
That would be a difficult one, depending on how the web application was set up.
But similar things could easily happen.
But yes, yeah. Definitely. Yep. You see it all the time in, and we'll get to this a bit later on, ads that are included on web pages.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a third party ad will display on your web page as part of an ad network, and it will be HTML typically that you're including from another server, and it will contain some JavaScript that will do something nasty.
Mm.
The annoying example is that it might make a little div float across the page. Drives me spastic. But it can do a lot more damage than that. Mm. We're talking about injecting JavaScript there. Any content that you allow users to enter into your web application is a potential attack vector,
yep.
Both against your server in the standard obvious case, but also in your users.
Yep.
Flash and ActionScript are notoriously bad. Or having various vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Adobe do update the Flash executables on a reasonably regular basis.
Yep.
But the problem, I mean, when you're getting a vulnerability coming out every month, there's a lot of damage that can be done.
The frightening thing really is the network, the distribution network. It's centralized, which is... centralized, you get your update from Adobe.com, right?
Right.
But the negatives here is that
the you content don't really get you're prompted receiving.
For it. Like, you don't really find out about it.
If you're your
average user who goes to YouTube.com and you don't have Flash installed, YouTube will tell you that you need to install Flash, but will not tell you whether 10.0.1. Whatever build you have running on your machine. And this runs on this is cross-platform, is the big thing to notice. It runs on Linux, Mac, you know, everything under the sun. Any browser that has Flash support. Yeah. So you might not be aware that there's a huge security flaw and that you should be operating to 10.0.1.11, whatever.
Yeah, but the same is true of any other operating system. True.
So, like, it's more of a piss take of that structure than any particular technology.
Yeah, but what's your alternative?
Well, look, there are other centralized models, like, for example, the update manager for the Mac or the update manager for Microsoft Windows, but it's pushed out. It's a push sort of...
That's true. I mean, you're still beholden on the software developer to release the patch, but at least you're notified when the patch comes out.
As opposed to here, you need to be in the know,
yeah.
Which sucks, yeah. Particularly with something as ubiquitous as Flash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a prime target for, oh my god, hacksaws.
Yep. Flash, JavaScript, ActionScript, the whole shebang.
Yep. Yep. So, we've got another note here. Oh, yeah, this one should go without saying. If you're sending sensitive information over the wire, like credit card details, like, you know, somebody's home address, you really should be using SSL.
Yep.
If I'm a malicious attacker sitting on a server somewhere and sniffing packets that are passing through, and you're sending credit card numbers over in unencrypted plain text...
Anyone in the middle between you, whether it's locally, your wireless hotspot...
And you have no idea what's happening in between your server and your client's browser.
Yep.
You know, any number of things could be occurring. All it takes is a disgruntled ISP employee to write a bit of software that's going to sit there and sniff out credit card numbers. So for God's sake, use SSL. And it's there for a reason.
Say what SSL is?
Secure Sockets Layer.
Yep.
Basically, those wonderful little certificates that you get from... a web page that you go to that say this content is signed and we're now using an SSL connection and it puts a little padlock there.
Or on Firefox you can click on the favicon in the URL bar and you get more insecurity information, so yeah.
And what's actually happening there is it's setting up a two-way encrypted conversation between your browser and the server.
And it verifies the server to be of the person who made the security, who registered the security for that domain.
That's right.
Yep.
There's been a number of, over the years, vulnerabilities in that architecture.
But you need 300 PlayStation 2s to start cracking those certificates.
Yeah, it's pretty secure. Thing. It works
quite well.
It's still possible to intercept the communications at both ends before they're encrypted. It's still possible to do a man-in-the-middle attack where you can decrypt the information that's being passed.
And the ISP could theoretically spoof you. That's right.
But it's just that little bit harder. Yeah, so much harder. If you've got the option to use SSL, yes, it can be a little bit expensive sometimes to get a site certificate. Really, you've just got to pay it. You've just got to do it.
While we're on the topic, I should mention, if you're really interested more in the technical specifics of SSL, Security Now did an entire hour-long podcast, which in-depth described SSL and the various attack vectors against it. So we'll put that in the show notes, perhaps. Next up.
Storing passwords. I don't even why. Really, this should go without saying.
Yeah.
I don't know why we're even discussing this.
Even as a designer, guys, do not store your passwords in fucking clear text. Simple as that.
And I really have seen applications where people have done that. They've stored user passwords in the database in plain text.
Yep. Banks have done it. That's fucked up.
Banks.
Banks have done it, indeed. Yep. Security Now, again, showed that a couple of months back, there was a major US bank that did it. And there are, of course, other implications that come with passwords. And, you know,
they were storing passwords
in
their database in clear text.
Yes. Yeah, it was an employer confirmed it, I think.
God help us all.
Yeah. And while on the subject of passwords, similar things, password length. If a user can put in a password that's 24 characters long, don't truncate it at 8 characters.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a bit silly. My bank, Westpac, they're an Australian bank for our international listeners.
Major Australian bank.
They truncate passwords at, I believe, 7 characters?
Jeez.
It might be 6 characters. I forget off the top of my head. But my typical high security password can't be used. Mm. They also have a really crappy, I understand why they did it, but they've got a web interface that requires you to click on buttons to enter your password.
I have another bank that does that, and it's only 4 digits.
Oh dear.
Yeah. And that's my savings account, man.
Oh dear.
4 digits.
Do you know how easy that is to break? That's we're talking about a matter of minutes to get a password like that.
It's an 8 character publicly known to some degree.
Like an arbitrarily guessable.
It's an account number, so anyone that I do business with will get hold of that account number.
Oh dear.
And it's a 4 character.
So, if anybody wants to get access to
my
Pascal's
savings
account...
Actually, while we're on it, fuck it. Because the bank needs pulling out, it's fucking ING.
It's ING. There we go. We said it. It's out there.
Yeah.
So, four character password, and...
4 character
all
numeric
I have to do,
password.
All I have to do to get the ID to sign in is get the account number, which I can get if you send me an invoice, for example.
Yeah, you should get the account number off me.
Well, Pascal, I think you better charge me for this podcast.
Yeah, so that's kind of fucked up. Actually, furthermore, there are some banks, and this goes beyond banks, seriously. If you allow alphanumeric characters, allow upper and lower case. Don't turn that into, you know, don't
ignore case sensitivity.
Case sensitivity is important, and don't negate it. Sorry,
the flip side of that password discussion, of course, is you should give your users every opportunity to make their own password as secure as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You should not be forcing them to adhere to some arbitrary rules about password strength, though.
Yep.
I've seen web applications that won't allow a password. The Optus Meizu web portal, which is I'm going to put it out there, absolute fucking schmozzle. It's a disaster zone.
Mm-hmm.
Optus, seriously, do something about your web interface because it's shit.
Well, it has the word Optus in it, so I'll just go by that.
Anyway, yeah, I'm not going to knock them on that basis alone.
Oh, Vodafone's is shite as well, so...
Anyway, they asked me for a password. I enter my standard security password, not my high security one, but not my low security one.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell me that it doesn't contain enough special characters. Well, here's a little news for you. I don't want to use special characters in my password. I've got a password that I use for things that I consider of medium security value. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Don't tell me how to make my passwords, goddammit.
Mm. So yeah, that's passwords covered. Next up, well, this kind of starts to tie into the more designy type sort of stuff.
Begins the wank.
Yeah, so this one's sort of another point that I guess worth offering is allow users to not save all of the data that you necessarily want or need. Like, perfect example here is if I'm making a purchase on a website, don't force me to become a member. That really, really sucks. Don't make me pick a password, give you an email address, give you my full name, and then save all my data. Why should I trust you with my credit card data for
ever and ever and ever and ever?
Indefinitely, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and really, if the point of selecting a product, entering my shipping address, giving you the money, should be a much quicker process and should not need or require a signing up. So maybe even don't require a username. Can you just use my email address instead? That makes life so much easier for me.
Yep.
I don't have to remember which username I gave you and so forth.
You should be seriously considering whether you really need, as a developer, whether you really need to store that details. Information.
Yep.
You
can even, if you want it for statistics, you can still store it one time. You've got it once for when they put in things like shipping details. But you don't need a username, and they don't need to necessarily create an account. You can still get your statistics if you must have them that way.
Well, I mean, if you're storing the data for statistical purposes, then you might as well be storing it for other purposes as well.
In which case, why are you storing my data? And I want to know about it. Or at least you should put it into your terms of service and whatnot. And again, this ties on to more stuff that I'm going to talk about in a second, make it easy and legible to read. So, yeah, as a designer, well, you're going to have to explain the concept here, the concept of the sort of security theater.
So we talked about actual security. And things that need, some of the things that need to be considered making a website secure. We're now talking more about the semblance and impression of security.
Perceived security.
It's important, if you've done all the right things and you have a secure site, it would be useless to then have users come to your site and feel insecure.
Yep.
The flip side of this is that you can't just make your users feel secure and not actually provide them any security that will backfire when it all goes horribly wrong.
It can sometimes backfire much worse than if you had a...
That's right. And this is the concept of security theater. The idea that we do things to make ourselves be secure that actually just make us feel warm and fuzzy.
Yep.
Perfect example. You get on a plane and you're told that you're not allowed to carry on any bottles of volume greater than 100 mils.
Yep.
However, you can carry 3 or 4 bottles of 100 mils or less on with you.
Yep.
So, a dedicated attacker who wants to do horrible things in your aeroplane just has to carry on 4 bottles of 100 mils or less rather than one 400 mil bottle of X dangerous substance.
And sometimes even there are substances that only when mixed become dangerous. Yep. So you're actually providing them with the
means to care or
the excuse or whatever you want to call it. Yeah. But,
so the important thing here is that you've made people feel secure by, you know, forcing them through all this rigmarole, but you haven't actually really made them secure.
Yep.
And that's security theatre.
Yep.
So we're talking now
by Bruce Schneier, I believe.
Bruce Schneier, yes. Whose blog is always worth a read.
Mm-hmm.
We're now talking about the good side of security theatre.
That security experience that you might have.
Yeah. So user experience from a security point of view, where it's a good thing as opposed to covering up blemishes in your web application and design. Yep.
And really, can be, maybe not just as, but can be similar or equally important because, well...
No, it's never equally important.
Maybe not equally, but okay, but getting there slowly perhaps... important because...
No, you know, not really.
You're not going to make any sales if people just feel insecure about your website. Or you'll make less sales.
Yes, I suppose that is actually
And if you want
important.
The money at the end of the day to pay your developers to make secure websites, then...
Alright, fine. It is sort of important.
Okay, there we go. Cool. So, first up on the list really is
the legal text that you've got on your website and the legal crap that's in your footer, make it legible. Don't make it tiny, tiny, tiny. It's like buying a product that's got, you know, 10 paragraphs of size 6 font.
Yeah.
Yeah. Make it legible. Put yourself out there and say that your legal stuff is important.
If you see a whole bunch of small print attached to a product, you'll immediately think to yourself, holy crap.
Me over the table.
Yeah, yeah, I'm being taken for a ride here.
Yeah, exactly.
So you want to make users feel comfortable with you as an entity.
Yep, the same thing applies to form elements, buttons, input field. Make them large. Make them clickable and easy to use, right?
Yeah, make them all novelty size so that even the little kiddies can push them.
Exactly.
I'm being condescending there, Pascal. I'm paying you that.
I'm trying to skip over that.
Okay.
So, next up, if you're a legit, real, ethical dealer, then why not act like it and instantly separate yourself from a large swathe of the scum out there by giving a physical address and maybe a phone number, like a contact detail. Your email address, definitely, right?
And an ABN.
And an ABN. Well, and we should explain here, an ABN is an Australian business number. It's a government... run or indexed set of numbers that correlate to businesses and to their...
If you're a business, you have to register with the government as a business.
Yep.
And you get this ABN.
You get this ABN. And different countries, the UK has stuff like that. Any real capitalist country has that, basically.
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah.
For the most part. And they can look up in the government index and see your name and see an address and maybe a phone number and such.
As a security thing for your users, so that they can verify your identity, make it possible for them to get in touch with you. Now, you know, you might not want them really getting in touch with you, but at least make it possible for them to do a check.
Make it possible for them to make a check and, if need be, send you a legal document. Like, if something happens, I want to be able to send you, who I've given my money to, a physical letter from my lawyer, if that ever needs to happen. And just having the opportunity to do that, or knowing that there's the opportunity, is a real...
Lawyers all use email these days.
It gives me that fuzzy feeling. Continuing. When you have a call to action, or rather, throughout the call to action, offer the user information of where they're up to and how many steps are left. So, you know, number the steps, like 4 steps.
So give the user comfort in the process that you're putting it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, tell them that they're in the checkout process and they've got 2 steps to go and they need to give them your shipping details and credit card number and confirm and that's it.
If you're going to make me jump through your arbitrary stupid hoops, then at least tell me how many stupid hoops I need to jump through.
That's the simple way of putting it. Next up is consider dropping CashCas. Those are those ugly, horrible... arbitrary string of text that's been munted and garbled that you're supposed to decipher and then input in to submit your comments.
So you'll know them, the little rectangle image, which has a couple of squiggly lines on it and then some heavily distorted images of letters.
Mm-hmm.
And it asks you to enter those letters into a text field.
Yep, exactly. So
the idea here being that the human eye will be able to easily decipher what those images are,
whereas
what the letters are.
Will not.
Whereas a computer won't.
Won't.
Unfortunately, it turns out that there are a bunch of algorithms that can easily decrypt those.
Mm-hmm.
Not decrypt, but interpret them.
Mm-hmm.
There's also things like Amazon's, what do they call it? The Mechanical Turk? Basically, you get a bunch of humans together and you pay them...
Some poor kid in India.
25 cents, or you give them unlimited access to a Russian porn site in return for responding to one of those capture images in real time and entering the appropriate text. So you can a computer program can be written that will harness humans as a processing element.
It's nice to know that poor Indian children are... hacking my interwebs and getting access to porn.
Now, come on, let's not be melodramatic.
I'm just continuing your...
More often than not, it's going to be people being offered access to porn sites at cutthroat rates.
That's pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
Wow.
The things people will do for porn.
So the argument here really is that since CAPTCHAs suck in terms of they are crackable, as in by machines in an automated process in some form, and that they suck for usability, like being able to... decipher it, even for people who have perfect vision, why not use something that is roughly equally hard or easy for an automated process to crack and is so much easier for you to decipher and accessible in terms of...
So you're proposing here...
Ask a simple question. Is rain wet or dry? Is fire hot or cold? And again, these are the more, like, popular ones, like, is fire hot
and
cold.
Obviously we're asking for a free text response as opposed
to a
yes,
for
no,
response, yeah.
Because that would
defeat
the purpose.
And you need to make sure that, you know, you offer things like, is fire hot or cold, that hot, you have the different answers could be hot with a period at the end, hot with a capital H to begin with. You need to obviously account for things like that, right?
And you've also got to have more than one question. I mean, you're going to have a whole library of these questions.
You need to have a whole library or alternate is a good thing, or... yeah,
the advantage of captures is that they can be randomly generated.
Yes, but...
Whereas if you've got only got an arbitrary number of these questions,
mm-hmm.
I could go through the whole lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
I only have to get the answers to each of them once.
Yep.
And then... there's no security left there. Now, there wasn't much security to start with the capture, but at least it was randomly generated, so that it couldn't just be guessed.
That's true, but the benefits here are greater, in my opinion, than the drawbacks in terms of it's accessible, it's clear text, screen readers will be able to read it. Yeah, so that's, I think, the biggest benefit, and it doesn't suck for people who even have perfect vision.
Okay.
And you can formulate more difficult questions that are still easier for humans to answer.
I think... There is another alternative,
and then you got to
which was the kitty capture.
Kitty capture.
It basically you present a bunch of images to the user, and you ask them to identify which of the images contain a cute little kitty.
That's awesome.
And it's very difficult to write a program that.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's not so cool for people who are vision impaired, unfortunately.
That's true. That's the big. That plus in this is that it's just clear text.
Yeah, but I really think that asking these questions... I mean, because you've only got an arbitrary number of these questions, really you've beaten the... You've lost any security that you had.
I think you still have some. And then... it's a contentious issue, I guess. I mean, you still got things
I guess it's the difference between a little bit and a little bit.
Yeah, and really? And you've got to... I guess it comes down to a process of weighing the pluses and minuses.
Put it this way, if we could solve this whole capture problem and come up with a good way to verify that it is really a human sitting at the other end of the web form, we'd be millionaires.
Yeah.
We wouldn't be doing this podcast.
No, we wouldn't.
We'd be sitting on a beach in Tahiti or Thailand and drinking mojitos.
Yum.
I think it's time for a holiday.
Yeah, why aren't we doing that?
Moving right along.
Moving right along. So, next up, offer users to hash or hide their passwords, or not, in a password entry field. So the idea here is that if I'm sitting at home and I'm entering my ultra-high security bank password, I can, on occasion, make mistakes, and that sucks, because it gets recorded by the bank, and if I make, you know, a number of them,
and
get
you use
out.
A pretty long password.
And I use a, like, if I'm doing something with the bank, then I prefer, like, a 12 to 20 plus character.
Assuming they haven't truncated it.
Assuming they haven't truncated it and fucked with it in some other way, yeah. So, but if I'm at, down at my favorite coffee shop, tethering with my iPhone, or heaven forbid, even using an open access point, I want those passwords to be hashed, so they were
as in
them,
the
like,
display
obscured.
on the screen so that people walking past you
can't look
be...
over my shoulder and instantly take a photo or get my password or look at it or whatever.
Sure.
Yeah, so this is just and it's just a simple button, you know, hash or unhash, and the default should be hashed. That's simple, or obscured, or whatever you would like to call it.
Fair enough. It's yep. you could do that with JavaScript.
Yep.
It's sort of non-standard behavior, but it shouldn't be overly difficult to implement.
No.
I do like Apple's implementation where
on the iPhone,
you enter a password and it shows you for a brief period the last character that you entered unhashed.
Before it gets hashed as well.
Before it gets hashed as well.
Yep, that's
so
nice.
That can help in reducing password entry errors.
Yep.
The advantage of something like that too is that if people are less inclined to make mistakes on their passwords, they might be more inclined to use more complex passwords.
Yep.
A lot of the time we see users simplifying the passwords that they use or reusing the same very
That's
simple
true.
Passwords.
I haven't thought of that. That's interesting, yeah.
Because they're so hard to remember.
Yep.
I mean, even security professionals have been known to use passwords like fuck.mysql, not naming any names, but if you're in the security industry, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Do tell.
We won't get into it right now. But
another time, perhaps.
Yeah,
okay.
I'll put it up in the show notes.
Okay. Next up is, well, this is more really much more of a user experience kind of thing. Just ask or offer users to check over their data before they submit something. It just sucks, particularly in not well programmed call to action chains or anything, whereby you fuck something up and you've got to start all over again.
I'm going to level an accusation at you here, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to accuse you of perpetrating wank that has nothing to do with security.
Okay, that did slip in there by accident, I apologise. But nonetheless, I hope our users might gain some benefit from it.
Alright, I guess we can allow that one. Okay. I won't edit it out.
Good.
It's valid advice, very much so.
The next stuff, though, moves away even further, I guess, from security. It's more of a implied security or...
Well, what's the point of having a subject if we're going to move away from it?
It's still important and still ties in with security, so I guess we'll mention it less. So the next one is keep the language simple. So in terms of avoid those lengthy, horrible terms of service agreements, the checkbox or the little text input field where the term of service or the privacy statement or whatever is in... Don't make it courier, don't make it 70 characters per line, and don't make it, like, 4 lines high with vertical and horizontal scroll bars in every direction. It's just ridiculous. Make it plain, easy to read, allow you to print it out if you want to. You know, don't tick it off into a text box, it sucks.
As we were discussing this a little bit earlier, and Pascal pointed out that it is possible to make clearly worded legal...
English, plain English.
Legal documentation... The average person can understand that doesn't use legal jargon.
Yep. And get that signed off by a lawyer. Yeah. There was a... I apologize for not getting your name, but there's a Dutch freelancer, I believe. This article was on 24ways.org. Who formulated and got signed off basically a legal contract. The contract that he signs with clients for websites that he makes for them. And it's freely available. You can grab the text file of this contract and just sub in your parts and it's pretty much legally standing, and it's just simple, plain, easy to read English, basically. Yes.
Which is nice. That's the way it should be.
Which is nice. How many of us really read those TOS agreements and whatever else?
Honestly, I almost never do.
Not the same.
I think I've read through maybe one of them out of curiosity.
Yeah.
It's pretty dry reading. I would highly recommend having a case of beer on standby to make the experience a little more enjoyable, because let's face it, that's the only way you're going to have
any
fun.
And really, even as a manager or a CEO or a CTO of your company, ask yourself, do you read those? Or is the only reason you know them because you've paid a lawyer to do it for you?
Mm.
Yeah, so think about...
What are you really paying for? What are you getting?
Yeah.
Like, you know, what are the terms that are actually in your agreement? Do you really know what you've signed up for?
Yep. And how many angry emails from customers who didn't read it or found it hard to read or skipped over it are you going to negate by doing that?
Probably, yeah, you probably wouldn't get... You'd never get many of those emails in the first place, because nobody reads the bloody things!
Yeah, but people still be pissed off with you.
Oh.
So, next up is really moving into the management and legal stuff, and this is a small segment, but the first one really is, oh my fucking god, steer clear of third-party advertisement bullshit. And really what comes down to, if you're going to rely on third-party advertisers...
Hang on, when you're saying third-party advertising bullshit...
Mm-hmm.
Are you suggesting that I shouldn't have ads on my site at all?
No. Vet them. Have a look at them. See what they do. And importantly, what was that big scam recently? The buy.com, the company that they're third-party advertiser, whereby in the checkout process you get a $10 coupon thing, and the only way to get past that and continue along in your checking out process is to give them your email address. And a lot of people are like, oh, what the fuck? I'll just put them in some, you know, less used or junk email address.
So buy.com, we're aggregating ads for various other businesses.
I can't recall that.
Oh, name. So they were doing it for a third party, and the third party was capturing people's email addresses.
And the third party pays buy.com to be put into this process. And buy.com gives your credit card details onto this third party that makes regular... He definitely pulls money from your account.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And people found out to like $20 a year was disappearing. They were like, where the fuck is this money going off to? And investigated and found out in the legal code that basically buy.com says, and they came out and publicly stated this to an interviewer, that to CNET, this was on CNET, so this is big, buy.com said that they will give out your credit card details and any other personal details they've accumulated from you if they deem, and in their quotation words, I'm paraphrasing, was... if they believe you, they can give you further value-added whatever.
Oh dear.
So it's arbitrary, up to them, and it sucks. So,
basically, if you're going to include somebody else's HTML and images in your website, because, I mean, there's, as we discussed earlier, there's all sorts of security vulnerabilities.
Even there in itself,
Vet the people that you're getting your ads from. Know who your ads are coming from and how they're getting there and what they're doing when they're on your site.
Yep, so this even goes beyond, like, the moral, ethical stuff that's what they're advertising to the security downright issues that come with it. The legal issues, you know. Are you giving your customers' details to these guys who are then charging money from you?
Mm.
Yeah, that really sucks.
The same thing is true of... I mean, that was a case of... Were buy.com taking orders for other companies? Is that what was
happening? No. So you wanted to purchase something from buy.com, and as you gave them your details to purchase that, they gave those details onto I've actually got the statement here. So the statement from buy.com was, "We reserve the right to use or to disclose personally identifiable information for business reasons in whatever manner desired."
That's not a very good privacy agreement.
That's not nice.
That's not a privacy agreement at all. Sorry. That's a privacy disagreement.
Yeah, that's buy.com's privacy agreement. So
disagreement.
No, that's shit. So I guess that's really the last...
There's still other things to talk about. I thought of a point while we were on this. Okay. I'm winging this one a little bit. It's not in our notes. I'm going off the record. We have notes. Of course we have notes.
I thought we were magical and genius and
completely. We referred to the notes earlier in the episode.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, we just naturally have conversations like this that are structured. Anyway, if you're doing e-commerce stuff, there's a number of e-commerce providers out there that will take care of the whole shopping cart dealio and, you know, taking payment for you.
Mm-hmm.
They'll take a cut of the profits.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, it works out as being a pretty good deal. You see a lot of places, you know, a lot of small shops that do handheld, you know, handmade jewelry using these sorts of, you know, Etsy. I'm not going to use them as an example because they seem to be pretty good.
They're pretty good.
But there are a number of them out there that are very, very dishonest. A lot like buy.com, who will quite happily take your information and do horrible, horrible things with it. Always vet the people that you're using as your, you know, e-commerce providers. It just goes without saying. Don't use fly-by-night.
Yep.
I mean, Chinese gold farmers and whatever.
And this is a case of where the views of Andy regarding buy.com are not solely those by Andy. In fact, I represent the same super views. So sorry, buy.com. You guys can fuck off and fix your shit up before I'll ever consider doing anything with you ever again.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. So that brings us roughly to the end of
yet another
episode two.
Episode two. We can't say yet another podcast quite yet.
No, we're not that far into the process.
No.
I would like to take this opportunity to just say a great big fuck you to Apple. Apple, fuck you. The whole Google Voice app debacle has really shown Apple's colours. I'm very, very disappointed in the way that the App Store is being managed. As somebody who is in the process of developing software that will eventually go onto the App Store, I'm really concerned by Apple's attitude, and I think everybody else should be as well. So, Apple, fuck you.
Okay, fair enough. Just trying to think if there are any similar sort of... The big one really was buy.com.
Buy.com?
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you as well.
Fuck you.
Yeah.
Do we have a tip of the cap for anyone? Do we have a thumbs up? Has someone done anything wonderful that you can think of?
Funny how we live in that society where we always think of the negatives.
I know.
It's one of those moments where I'm trying to sit here pulling up all the awesome shit people have
done. I think we need to make this a
segment. And I'm going to feel bad because I'm going to get off this and like be reminded like half a minute later about something I should have given a plug, so...
We'll have to Twitter about it later, and I think what we'll do in future is we'll have
A segment out of this. Fuck the fuckers, and...
We need to think of something similarly clever. Tip
the
hat to
the awesome dudes, yeah.
We can't use tip of the hat, because they do that on Triple J, one of the local radio shows.
Yeah.
We don't want to totally copy.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think. Nothing really comes to mind that's frightening.
That is a bit worrisome, isn't it?
Yeah, I know.
We'll get back to you on that one.
We'll get back to you. Cool.
Anyway, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. As always, you can find the wonderful Andy at
arcwhite.org, ARCWHITE arcwhite.org.
Yep, that's where the podcast is syndicated as well. So...
I'm on Twitter as arcwhite.
Yep.
And my email is arcwhite@arcwhite.org.
Yep.
And the lovely Princess Pascal can be found at...
Klepas.org, K-L-E-P-A-S.org.
Slow that down.
K-L-E-P-A-S.org.
And a little slower.
I will not repeat yet again.
Damn it.
Actually, update regarding the site. I'm almost finished in putting the new version up. I'm really looking forward to it. And I've just been basically fixing up some copy, as in the body copy of the pages. And I have some technical stuff to run through, some RSS sort of things, and need to make a print style sheet. And when I feel like torturing myself, check it in IE. Maybe.
Ooh, you're into sadomasochism.
Yeah.
Kinky.
Fucking IE. I'm thinking of just not caring about it. I won't care about six at all.
It's past time that we got rid of IE.
Not even YouTube is going to support you guys. You can...
That's it. That's it. Right, it's up. Game over for IE6.
It's game over for IE6, yeah. So I'm almost done there. So I'm also on Twitter. Twitter.com/Klepas. And my email address is klepas@klepas.org. So yeah, we'd love to hear from you.
I do have one final point.
Mm-hmm.
The finalest point. Which is a big apology for us not doing a review of Open Atrium.
Yeah,
like we said we would.
To it. Yeah.
I did start installing it, and unfortunately I got sidetracked with a bunch of other stuff. I had a really busy week at work, so...
Mm-hmm.
That is coming. We will do the review of Open Atrium.
Definitely.
Promise.
So, similarly, I've got a friend of mine, Chris, has put up the domain, the subdomain, and has gotten everything ready. I just need to start installing Drupal in Open Atrium when I find the time. It's just uni and work and, well, getting up the next version of my site has gotten in the way. But we'll definitely do it.
We will.
Yep.
So, thank you for listening. Hopefully the audio quality is a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see you again. Hopefully. Hear you again. You'll hear us again.
That's
hopefully. Next week!
Indeed.
Thank you for listening. Good night.
Cheers. Bye.